From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, soccer riots. Authorities are trying to prevent riots next month at the European Championships in Sweden. We'll talk to Bill Buford, who joined up with a group of British soccer hooligans to find out why violence had become part of the game. His new book, Among the Thugs, is about the experience of crowd violence. Also, we'll meet Angelina Rayo, a soprano who's best known for her interpretations of Kurt Weill songs. And after the Rodney King beating and the L.A. riots, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we use the words force and violence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Officials in Bosnia are blaming Serbian forces for a mortar attack that killed at least 16 people today in an open-air market in Sarajevo. A Serbian commander denied the charge, and Yugoslav Federal Army commanders denounced the attack. The European Community imposed trade sanctions against Serbia today, blaming the Serbs for supporting the war in Bosnia. The BBC's Jane Howard reports from Belgrade, the Serbian capital.
The mortar bombardment hit the city center as people were queuing for bread. Bosnian television showed pictures of bodies and badly injured people lying in the street. Until then, the city had been relatively quiet, raising hopes that the plan to lift the blockade was succeeding. The Russian foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrev, said last night that he'd won an agreement in principle for a plan to reopen the airport, allowing humanitarian aid to reach the suffering. But the attack came just 4 hours after the ceasefire was due to come into force. Meanwhile, in Serbia, the Chamber of Commerce shrugged off the prospect of economic isolation. Other officials admitted that the sanctions meant there would be difficult times ahead. They repeated the view that there was no proof of Belgrade's direct involvement in Bosnia, and that the accusations against Serbia were groundless.
Jane Howard in Belgrade. The United Nations Security Council decided today to maintain its economic sanctions against Iraq. Council members charged that Baghdad is still not revealing all the details about its nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. Under the Gulf War ceasefire resolutions, all of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction must be eliminated. Earlier today, Iraq argued that it was complying with the UN weapons resolutions and said that the economic sanctions should be lifted to relieve suffering among Iraqi civilians. The U.S. Coast Guard intercepted 339 boat people today in international waters and returned them to Haiti under a recent White House executive order. The directive allows Haitian refugees to be returned without being interviewed for political asylum. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
Criticism of the Bush administration's new policy to forcibly return Haitian refugees without screening them has come under increasing attack. On Capitol Hill, Congressman John Conyers, chairman of the House Government Operations Committee, introduced a bill that would prevent refugees from being forcibly returned to Haiti until democracy there is restored. More than 35,000 refugees have been intercepted by the U.S. Coast Guard since a September military coup overthrew elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. About one-third have been granted entry into the U.S. to seek political asylum. Another 16,000 have been forcibly returned to Haiti. Meanwhile, 12,500 Haitians are being held at a tent city at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They are awaiting processing by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. I'm Sunni Khalid in Washington.
This is NPR News. The House has passed a wide-ranging energy package that aims to encourage conservation, provides tax breaks for renewable fuels, and boosts the nuclear and natural gas industries. The 381-37 vote sets up negotiations with the Senate, which has already passed its version of the measure. Compromise legislation is expected to go to the president before the November elections. A prominent congressional Democrat is retiring. Congressman Dante Fassell of Florida, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, announced today that he will not run for a 20th term from his district in southeastern Florida. NPR's Maeve McGoran reports.
Fussell told reporters today he was retiring for personal reasons, but said he might have waited a few more years if the boundaries of his district had not been redrawn. He said that during a tenure in Congress that stretched back to the Eisenhower administration, he was especially proud of his environmental legislation and his efforts to make human rights a foreign policy concern. But Fussell also indicated that in recent years, his job as head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee has gotten more difficult.
We do our best to impact on policy, and we do that in the way we expend the funds and the conditions that we put on the expenditures and the kind of communication that we had. And I must say that it's been a struggle.
Fussell is the 43rd member of the House to announce his retirement this year, the largest number in the history of Congress. 13 other members are leaving Congress this year to run for other public offices. I'm Maeve McGoran in Washington.
The human rights group Amnesty International is pressuring the African National Congress to respond to allegations that it has killed, tortured, or jailed ANC dissidents. The ANC, led by Nelson Mandela, is South Africa's largest black nationalist organization. Leaders of the ANC admit that there were some abuses when the organization was banned from operating in South Africa. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The biggest crowd control maneuvers in European history are planned for June, when the European Soccer Championships begin in Sweden. Authorities will try to prevent soccer riots, which in the past have destroyed neighborhoods, terrorized people, and ended in death. In 1985, at the European Cup final in Belgium, fights between Italian and British fans ended in 39 deaths. In 1989, at an Association Cup semifinal in England, 95 fans were killed in a crush. My guest Bill Buford says he wanted to know why young males in England were rioting every Saturday at soccer matches, so he spent many weekends through the 1980s traveling with soccer hooligans. His new book, Among the Thugs, is about the experience and seduction of crowd violence. Buford is the editor of the literary magazine Granta. He's an American who lives in England. He told me what got him interested in following the rioters.
I saw a group of supporters when they were leaving a football match. In fact, it was more than a group. It was some Liverpool supporters who'd taken over a train, and the train was stopping for some police reinforcements. It was a small suburban Welsh station where everyone around me spoke Welsh, and I was waiting to get a train to London. And the absolute power of this group, the sort of the sheer excitement that they felt of knowing that the train was theirs and that they could do anything they wanted. They were taking apart the tables and with the legs of the tables trying to break the windows. And they were chanting over and over again, a very simple, rudimentary chant, Liverpool, la, 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 Liverpool, la, la, la. But it was 400 or 500 people packed into this train. And I just found the power of the numbers awesome. And suddenly I realized that every Saturday there were a group of people who got together and behaved like a crowd and broke things and destroyed things and beat each other up. And I wanted to find out more. It didn't make sense to me that it was taken for granted in this way. I wanted to find out who these people were and what it was that was exciting them.
Well, if I asked you who were they, what could you tell me? I mean, as a group, is there a typical type of person who becomes one of the football thugs?
Well, if you're told that there's a group of young people, young males, 19 to 21, 22, 24 years old, in Britain, who get together and riot on a fairly routine basis, then you would probably assume, as certainly I assumed, that they're disenfranchised in some way, that these are the unemployed, that these are people without hope, that they are the disenfranchised. What I found, in fact, was exactly the opposite. They have jobs. Some of them work in banks. They're accountants. They work for British Telecom. They're painters. They're decorators. They're taxi drivers. They are the heart of the male working class, except that there really isn't a working class anymore in Britain. They're the children of the working class. They're sort of the new consumer suburban generation of Britain.
As you point out in your book, crowds and riots are often portrayed from the victim's point of view, and you tried to capture what it's like to just be a part of that crowd, not the victim of the crowd. The expression that's used in the soccer riots is "it's going off" when things are about to explode. Can you give us a sense of what it feels like when it's going off?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I discovered is that in the whole history of crowd violence, most people write about it from the outside. They don't write about it from the inside. They write about it as someone who's reading about it, or somebody who's on the balcony when the crowd comes charging down the street, or somebody who is one of its unfortunate victims. I ended up being in a rather privileged position of being with a group of people who work themselves up into such a state that they could very self-consciously cross that threshold of civilized conduct to become members of a crowd. And I saw it again and again and again. And there are a number of illusions or fallacies, really, about crowd violence, which I think come because most people look at the crowd from the outside. And one of the fallacies is that a crowd is mindless, or a crowd needs a leader, as if people really wouldn't behave as irrationally as they do in a crowd unless someone else made them do that. What I found is that this is a group of people who knew that they had to reach almost a special kind of state. They had to work themselves up into a special kind of state to be able to cross that border of civilized conduct. And there might be, at the moment I'm speaking to you from London, and it wasn't far from here that I was at a Chelsea match. Chelsea is one of the South London teams, when the team that I was following, Manchester United, came down for a big game. And afterwards, the supporters would slip out one by one. They'd slip out past the police protection, and they would start to form a group and realize that they were forming a group. And then this very sense of their forming a group gave them a kind of power. It gave them a strength that they didn't have. And as more and more people got together, the group itself got stronger and stronger, and they would start to chant, to work themselves up into this state where they could cross that threshold of civilized conduct. And there's that moment when they can tell that they're about to cross the threshold. And that's when this phrase recurs: it's going to go off, it's going to go off, it's going to go off, meaning it's going to explode, or it's going to it's going to be out of control, or it's going to, everyone will no longer be individuals anymore, they will be members of the crowd. It's going to go off, it's going to go off, and then it finally, something happens, usually something physical. Glass breaks, or somebody breaks a piece of property, or somebody smashes a car. Usually it's some item of property. And this sense of containment, of being civilized, this respect for the law, is obliterated in an instant.
You know, one of the things you say is that what you hadn't expected was that the violence would be so pleasurable. You say there was an intense energy about it. It was impossible not to feel some of the thrill. Would you explain that, what you were feeling?
It's the thrill of adrenaline excitement. You've got a group of people who are setting out to inflict injury on people, who are setting out to make violence. And there's enormous anticipation, there's preparation, there's the expectation of violence. Finally, the act of violence itself is spectacularly full. It's a very, very full moment. It's a moment of danger, excitement, fear. It's an animal moment, an adrenaline moment, an instinct moment. When you are as concentrated into the present tense as you could possibly be. There's no future, there's no past, there's no reflection. There's nothing mediating between you and the experience.
Now, in one riot you were in, I think it was the last riot you were in Italy, there was a big march that turned into a riot, and you ended up being clubbed by the police. Let's start with the march. What kind of march was this supposed to be? Why a march?
I still can't figure out why a march. The Italian authorities were so terrified of the England supporters that they went out of their way to make the England supporters' time absolutely miserable. And I think the march was this bizarre, spontaneous display of English solidarity. They just wanted to prove that they could be a crowd. and a game that was meant to start at 9 o'clock in the evening. Suddenly everybody was marching for the game at 6 o'clock in the evening. It was just a bizarre, spontaneous protest, and 4,000 people took over the city and started marching to the game.
What happened when the police moved in? How did the Italian police respond to the riot?
They moved in with lots of people and guns and tear gas and all the things that provokes an English lad, I think. Finally, at the end of it, the Italian police retreated, and the England supporters, who had been very quiet all day, they hadn't been drinking, they hadn't been chanting, they hadn't been singing, broke out in this chant for England. England, England, England. Not knowing that if the Italian police were retreating, they were retreating because they were going to snap back in some fashion. And I was just waiting for them to snap back. I was convinced they were going to come chasing after us. And within minutes, they did, as tear gas rained down on everybody's head. And I sprinted ahead of the pack and ran up a hill, determined to get away from them, only to discover that we were trapped and that on the other side of the hill there were 2,000, a very large number of Italian police waiting for the England supporters. And they thought, I think, that I was one of the leaders.
Why would they think
that? And I could see that I think because I was the first one over the hill. And in my determination to get away from the Italian police, I ended up getting to the front of the pack, and so that I was seen to be one of the leaders. I was certainly dressed like one of them. I should note that the place was, there was almost as many journalists as there were police, because everybody was there for the England supporters to behave badly. But I wasn't wearing journalist credentials so that I could mix with the supporters comfortably. And I didn't have the big, heavy yellow tags that say that you're press. And I could see that there was nothing I was going to be able to do, and I got down on my hands and knees and hid between two cars. Police behind me, police in front of me, and no way out. Only to be severely beaten up by three policemen who then surrounded me and then just thwacked me endlessly, one going at my kidney and one going at my head and one trying to reach my collarbone.
And they hit you many, many times. And in describing that in your book, you say that you were both experiencing the pain and thinking about how to describe it because you knew that this was something you'd have to write about.
I had a different experience from the others. They were actually extremely violent. I have never seen so much hatred concentrated in a person's face as I found in the face of those Italian police when they came charging up the hill. I knew there was no way that I could start squealing "Giornalista, Giornalista" to stop them from beating me up. It was just concentrated physical hatred, and the supporters around me were really quite badly injured. There was a lot of broken legs and a lot of blood and a lot of cracked foreheads, and it was a little nationalistic battle. But it was also, I have to say, my experience of it was different because I was writing about it. The other supporters were getting beaten up, and they just hurt. I was getting beaten up and hurt, but also knew that I had the chance to end my book.
Right, you had a climax. And how did being beaten by the police in Italy change your grasp or your view of what the riots are about? Did it?
I don't think it did. It offered a slightly different perspective. I mean, I had been out to describe violence, and I was describing violence by being close to it. And now I was in a position where I could describe violence by being the object of it. What was interesting to me about that Italian experience was how much it was informed by nationalism. Just stupid, stupid, crude, masculine nationalism. Of a sort that made no sense whatever, and of a sort that looked like it was never, ever going to go away. It was just an enduring feature of male culture. The England supporters really wanted a war, and it didn't matter that it was the Italian police, though they're quite happy to fight the Italian police. It could have been the Dutch supporters. It could have been Dutch police. It could have been Russians. It could have been Romanians. They wanted a war. They wanted to defend their idea of England. They wanted to defend the Queen and the Union Jack and the Bulldog and all the people back home, even though all the people back home would really be quite happy for the supporters to be put in prison and the key thrown away.
My guest is Bill Buford, author of a new book about soccer riots. He's also the editor of the literary magazine Granta. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Buford, author of Among the Thugs, The Experience and the Seduction of Crowd Violence. I'm interested in something that happened to you after being in one of the soccer riots. You were going back home and you were getting onto the subway, lots of stairs that you had to get through to get to the train, which you were afraid you were going to miss. And you encountered on the stairs, you were really in a hurry, you encountered two elderly people, a couple, I think one of them used a cane, they were walking very slowly. You were so impatient that you pushed them aside and cursed them, which is the kind of behavior that is very out of character for you. But it sounds like some of the spirit of the soccer thugs was lingering. What came over you?
This was after I'd spent, I suppose, 3 days with the Manchester United supporters, and my whole point was that I was infiltrating the group and being with them, getting to know them. I wasn't pulling out my notebook. I was drinking with them, talking with them, being as close to the violence as I possibly could when there was violence. And when I came back feeling gritty and nasty and dirty and obviously much more influenced by them than I realized, I had taken on their code of rudeness. There's this, the supporters pride themselves on their anti-civilizing, rude conduct, where any rule is a rule to be broken, any social nicety is a nicety to ignore, and in fact they make a point of being as offensive and as rude as they possibly could, and this had influenced me to the extent that when I shoved these old people aside, I was really making a point of being rude to them. I think I got too close to my subject.
Did you scare yourself?
No. I don't think I've got very high moral expectations of myself. Okay. I was interested. I was intrigued by it. I was intrigued by myself as sort of, I became my own subject in some ways.
The European Championships will be held this month in Sweden, and Europe is preparing for the biggest crowd control maneuvers in the history of Europe. What are they planning? What can you tell us about what's being planned to prevent riots at the soccer championship?
Oh, I'd love to know what they're planning. They're obviously these pretty Swedish towns and cities are preparing for the spectacle of marauding supporters, drunk and smelling and stripped of their clothing, running through their streets, chanting, breaking windows and turning over cars and beating each other up. And what they're planning is how to contain that prospect. And I would love to know how they're going to do it. The English police have been advising them, and the English police are very good at controlling crowds. There's an established history, I suppose, of crowd violence, which has resulted in this very refined police tactics, which rest mainly on animals. By using dogs and horses, the England police have got very good at containing crowds. I've been able to see the way that different police in different countries do it. The Italian police are the worst. The German police are quite efficient, but not all that good. And I think the Swedish police at the moment are completely terrified.
Why are the Italian police the worst?
They do it with numbers. And they do it by over-arming themselves. Mm-hmm. They have bazookas and submachine guns and military helicopters, which, if used, presuppose that actually they would be slaughtering hundreds of football supporters. And the football supporters know they're not going to be, hundreds of them are going to get killed. So it's useless armaments. In the World Cup, they were firing guns in the air, and I think that was meant to terrify people into believing that maybe they'd get shot, and it had exactly the opposite effect. It somehow insulted them. So then they all charged the man with the gun. It's completely insane conduct on both parts, to my mind.
Do you think that there is a leadership within the group of violent soccer fans, or is it just a disorganized group thing?
Both, I think. The commonplace perception about crowds is that they have leaders. And this is commonplace because, in fact, they do have leaders. But what isn't true is that leaders make crowds. Whenever there's a crowd riot, there's always a great effort to arrest the leaders, as if they take the blame for the irrational conduct of all the people in the crowd. After the poll tax riot, Margaret Thatcher was determined to find the leaders. And after the Milltown Cemetery riots, where two soldiers were pulled out of their cars, beaten and killed, again, the government was determined to find the leaders. But what I found in my experience is that a crowd makes itself. The people in a crowd know what they're doing. They know the power they suddenly have by being numbers. And crowds make leaders possible. They need leaders. They're happy for leaders. They want to be led. They want to be directed. But whenever you see someone try to lead a crowd that's not going to be a crowd, the crowd refuses to follow, refuses to obey.
Have you ever been in the middle of a political riot?
I've been in the middle of political protests that became quite violent, usually involving the police.
Yeah. How did it feel different than what you experienced with the soccer thugs?
The soccer thugs was more intended, in that the objective was to get to that moment of crowd frenzy. The objective was to get to the moment of crowd violence. I mean, I made a point of actually trying to go to as many riots as a boy could. There aren't generally that many riots on offer, but there was the British coal strike in the early 80s. There was great industrial disputes involving the Times in South London at Wapping. And I tried to go to a lot of these just to see how the crowds behaved and who was leading them and whether there was a shared excitement about violence, if actually people there got a thrill out of it, if they enjoyed it in the way that the football supporters did. And I think they do, in the same way that I think that the riots in Los Angeles involved a lot of people who enjoyed rioting, enjoyed looting, enjoyed breaking the law. But the difference is that these people know what they're doing. They know what it takes to reach that frenzied state to become a crowd. They know the power of the crowd, and they've had the adrenaline, excitement, and the kick in the past, and they want it again. So it's much more intended. I think in most cases of crowd violence, people in a crowd suddenly discover they are a crowd and discover that power and that excitement. And it's arbitrary and almost impossible to predict, whereas these people know it. They want it again.
Do you still go to soccer games?
Yes, cautiously. And actually, I'm still in touch with quite a lot of the supporters. One in particular has decided he wants to go straight, that he's tired of violence, crime, and making money illegally, tired of going to jail, and now wants to become a normal human being, but he'd still like to have a great deal of money if that's possible. And he thinks that I'm going to be his guide to this for some reason. But in the course of this, actually, I've discovered the sport, and I enjoy it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Buford is the author of Among the Thugs. He's also the editor of the literary magazine Granta. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Angelina Rayo was singing in Broadway musicals when the saying, break a leg, took on literal meaning. Coming up, she'll tell us how she broke both legs during a performance of Sweeney Todd, and during the downtime, decided to make a career move. Now she's an opera singer and is internationally recognized for her interpretations of Kurt Weill. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the words force and violence were used in reporting the Rodney King story. Police used force to subdue King, and after the verdict, people rebelled with violence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. NATO defense ministers have decided to expand the role of the alliance throughout Europe and use troops for peacekeeping missions to try to prevent conflicts. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports.
NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner said that the North Atlantic Alliance must become involved in peacekeeping missions if it is to have a future role in post-Cold War Europe. Werner said NATO troops could be made available to the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe, but only if all 16 alliance members agree. The conference embraces both East and West European countries and the United States and Canada. The missions would not be automatic, but decided on a step-by-step basis, and Werner declined to say if troops would be deployed in the disintegrating Yugoslav Federation. Observers say the conflict in Yugoslavia has served as an example and prompted NATO to expand its role. But they add that the civil strife there has gotten so out of hand that peacekeeping missions are no longer sufficient to separate the warring groups and end the fighting. This is Sylvia Pagioli reporting.
At least 16 people were killed in Sarajevo when Serbian mortar fire hit people lined up to buy bread. The attack occurred as more than 100 people stood near an open market in the center of the capital. The attack came only 4 hours after a Russian-mediated truce went into effect. There have been a number of ceasefires, and none has held for more than a few hours. Meanwhile, the European community has voted for a trade ban against Serbia in an effort to stop the fighting in Bosnia. In New York City, the UN Security Council has decided to maintain economic sanctions against Iraq. This move comes after UN officials again accused Baghdad of concealing details of its weapons program. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The Security Council met again today for one of its periodic reviews of the Iraqi trade sanctions. As expected, the Council decided to keep the sanctions in place, disregarding Iraqi complaints that they were hurting innocent citizens. Council officials noted today that Iraq was still obstructing efforts by UN inspectors to find and eliminate its weapons of mass destruction. For instance, they said Iraq refuses to allow UN aircraft to land in Baghdad and has tried to block high-altitude surveillance flights. A report issued yesterday also accused Iraq of concealing some 92 missiles and then destroying them itself instead of turning them over to UN inspectors as required by the UN ceasefire agreement. Iraq rejected the charges. The sanctions were imposed on Iraq after its invasion of Kuwait. Among other things, they bar Iraq from selling oil. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 6 points to close at 3,370.44. This is NPR News. The Coast Guard says more than 500 Haitian boat people have been taken home again, including nearly 300 picked up yesterday. A spokesman says all those picked up yesterday were returned without immigration interviews. Over the weekend, President Bush ordered the U.S. Coast Guard to immediately return Haitian boat people without interviews to find out who might qualify for assignment. Up until then, the Coast Guard had been taking Haitian refugees to a temporary camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. A White House spokesman says that there are now fewer Haitian boats trying to travel to the U.S. and that the new policy is going unusually well. In Ohio, just one day before it was set to take effect, a new law restricting abortions has been struck down. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Had this law taken effect, women seeking abortions would have been handed pamphlets from the state health department, including photographs of fetuses at various stages. The women would also have had to wait 24 hours after that to get an abortion. But now, Common Pleas Court Judge Guy Reese has struck down the law. He says it violates not just four amendments of the U.S. Constitution, but also several special, and he says, stronger guarantees in the Ohio Constitution. One is called a freedom of conscience provision that he says, quote, must prevent the government from interfering in decisions that involve deeply held moral and philosophical convictions. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
State officials in Texas say that Ross Perot is now on that state's ballot. To qualify as an independent presidential candidate, the Texas billionaire needed more than 54,000 signatures of registered voters who did not cast ballots in the Republican or Democratic primaries March 10th. Perot is now on the ballot in seven states. He has said he will enter the race if his name is on the ballot in most states. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Angelina Rayo has a new recording of Kurt Vile's songs called Stranger Here Myself, the same title as the one-woman show she originated at the New York Shakespeare Festival. Boston Globe music critic Richard Dyer has described her as bringing the broadest range of vocal resource anyone has yet brought to Vile's songs, though this never degenerates into the mere display of vocal effects. She has a degree of identification with the material no one has matched since Lottie Lenya herself. Rayo started off on Broadway, but as we'll hear later, a bizarre stage accident eventually led her to opera. Before we meet her, let's hear her interpretation of Vile's song, I'm a Stranger Here Myself. The lyric is by Ogden Nash.
Tell me, is love still a popular suggestion? A merely an obsolete art? Forgive me for asking the simple question. I'm unfamiliar with his heart. I'm a stranger here myself. Why is it wrong to murmur I adore him when it's shamefully obvious I do? Does love embarrass him or does it bore him? I'm only waiting for my cue. I'm a stranger here myself. I dream of a day, of a gay warm day with my face between his. Have I missed the path? Have I gone astray? I ask, and no one understands.
That song comes from the musical One Touch of Venus. Rayo's album covers the three periods of Vile's career, his Broadway songs, his German songs, and his French songs. The French songs are the ones I'm least familiar with, so I asked her to talk about his song, J'attends un navire.
First of all, did you know that it was a song, it was used by the French Resistance during World War II as their code song?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, that's one of the really neat things about it. And unfortunately, this music, you don't know much about this period because Marie Galante has just started to be being sung and performed around the world in the last, I would say, 5 years. And the story, it's really neat. It's about this young French girl who lived in Bordeaux, and she gets kidnapped or whatever and ends up on this big cargo ship where the captain tries to seduce her. She's left on this island. She manages to make her way to Panama where she has to earn enough money to get back to Bordeaux. She becomes a prostitute. And this song is her big anthem, like, all I want to do is I'll carry my heart across the ocean. I just want to get back to Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm.
Some of Gravel's songs are sung in a style that's become known as Sprechstimme, which is a combination of speaking and singing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to play the end of Surabaya, Johnny, the way you've recorded it. And I'd like to hear you talk about Sprechstimme, how you've used that combination of speaking and singing in a dramatic way in his songs.
It's funny when you're first learning the song, you know, you're at the piano, you're behind the pianist's shoulder, and he's sitting at the bench, and you're learning the notes, and you're, you know, preparing it, and you say the lines, you know, they fall so flat and seem so empty, and you seem so silly. I mean, take that damn pipe out of your mouth, you rat. I mean, you can just imagine the terrors of that on a night when it's not working. I mean, believe me, fortunately, I was doing a master class for some prep school in New Jersey, and all these, very excited about theater and acting, all these young acting students, they came to hear me talk about Kurt Weill, and I sang Surabaya, Johnny for them. And these bunch of boys in the back row, you know, they were back there with all their friends, you know, and their T-shirts and their, you know, jams, those short pants that they wear, you know, and they were back there like kind of snickering. And as soon as I said that line, I knew that they were just going to howl. And I just said, what can I do? So I just like completely, never in my life, I think, have I performed it so convincingly, because I was determined to make them see why the composer chose not to make that musical, but to leave it, you know, so spare. And believe me, I mean, they were just like, it was like I had roped them into their seats. And at the end, when I met them, I said, I saw you guys, and you were going to laugh, weren't you? And they were like, oh no, wow, that was really incredible. You know, and that to me meant so much, because I think that's the power of, it's like silence often is very powerful, you know, in a play or in music. And I think that the spareness of not having anything underneath, and just the vulnerability of just having a singer speak something straight from his heart and intellect, I think is just can be an incredible moment.
Well, let me play part of your recording of Surabaya, Johnny, from your album Stranger Here Myself.
Though your name should have told me different, I had hoped we would soon settle down. But in every saloon on the coastline, they would cheer when you came to the town. And one day in a two-bit flop house, I'll wake up to the roar of the sea. And you'll leave without one word of warning on the ship waiting down at the quay. You have no heart, Johnny. You're just a louse, Johnny. How can you?
That's Angelina Rayo from her album Stranger Here Myself. After singing Surabaya, Johnny, a lot, can you always put into it the amount of drama that you want? Does it ever get old for you?
Well, of course, because some days you just can't concentrate, or you're not willing to just let yourself, you know, fall into somebody else. I mean, if you've had a bad day and, or whatever. But when I perform it, I always try, in every song that I do, especially when I'm repeating material over and over again, I try to always start at the beginning. I don't try to make a plan. I don't say, oh, and by the second verse, I'm going to be crying, and by the third verse, I'm going to be breathless and, you know, and feel like I'm 20 years older. Or I never make decisions like that. And Johnny, Surabaya Johnny, is like a drug. And every time I get to that verse, it's like he gives me this drug. And then I have to spend the next verse, you know, I spend the next verse being high on it for a while and then wanting it. Because the whole song, I mean, it's not just a song, you know, that was written in 1928 by, or 1929 by Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, but it's very specific to now. It could be anyone who is completely obsessed with something and doesn't know how to rid themselves of that obsession and to be their own person again.
Yeah.
And so that's what I try to do.
My guest is Angelina Rayo. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Angelina Rayo. She has a new album of Kurt Weill songs called Stranger Here Myself. Before you started singing opera, you performed on Broadway. You were in the national touring production of Sweeney Todd.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I might have seen you. Did you perform in Philadelphia?
I didn't make it to Philadelphia.
You didn't make it to Philadelphia?
You know why? I was the 13th performance when a stage accident happened. And my parents were in the second row. And it was at the Kennedy Center Opera House. In fact, where my parents lived at the time in Washington, D.C. And just an accident happened. My boots got stuck on some material, and both of my legs were broken. I had several, you know, operations and didn't walk for a while, but really had time to reevaluate my career and what I wanted to do. And I'd always had it kind of easy because I always had this kind of big voice, you know. I wasn't very disciplined or anything, and I always loved to perform, but I never really focused what talents I had. And Harold Prince, the Broadway producer, sent me William Weaver's book on Italian opera. And he'd always kidded me and told me that I was really an opera singer.
He was directing you in Sweeney Todd.
Right, he directed Sweeney Todd. And I guess he just really believed in me, and he sent me this book, and so after my first operation on my leg, I paid somebody to sing in the production of Faust. And
why did you have to pay?
Well, you know, it's those...
Is it vanity production?
Yeah, no, they're like... Well, I guess, but they're mainly for young opera singers in the city who don't have an opportunity to try out their craft. So these producers, in order to produce them, everybody contributes and gives money, so then they like have the money to put it on.
I see.
So there were like 8 marguerites in Faust, let me tell you. I mean, it was just... it was a trip. But anyway, someone heard me and gave me further encouragement, and I went to Santa Fe and I was an apprentice, and that was in 1984.
So I want to back up a little bit to the day that you were performing as the beggar woman in Sweeney Todd and you broke both legs. Exactly what happened to you on stage?
Well, I was really too short for that shoot. I don't know if your audience has seen Sweeney Todd, but it's about this barber and this, well, Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd, who, like, they put you in a barber chair, and Sweeney Todd cuts your throat, and then you are, the chair opens up, and you slide down this 6-foot drop into her basement where you're put in the oven and baked into pies. And so, anyways, when they put me in the chair, and I'm supposed to be, I can't move because supposedly I'm dead to the audience, and we're trying to make it as real as possible. But that evening, when they pushed the lever, I fell in a funny way, and my rubber boots, I had big rubber galoshes on, and the tips of them got caught on the padding. And so, you know, unfortunately, my legs weren't free to do a free fall, and they got kind of crushed. So my ankles and my feet are what really took the beating. But I'm fine. You know, I have a little arthritis in the rain, and rake stages kind of do me in.
Did you scream in pain, and did the audience hear you?
Did I scream in pain? I kept telling Angela Lansbury, I kept saying, take off my... No, what did I say? Pull me on stage. And she was like, my dear, can you get up? And I said, pull me out on stage, because I had one scene left. And she goes, well, I can't unless you show me that you can get up. So she took my wig off, and she gave it to my understudy, who was, like, in the chorus. And she finished the show, and... I could see my understudy through the cracks in the set that I was on stage. I was still on stage, but I was in the house unit. I could see someone else playing my part, and I was crying. Or they say, I was in shock. But everyone thought I was crying because my legs hurt. But no, I was crying because I knew that it was the end of something that was very important to me. And because it was the 13th performance of a year's tour, and I would have been on the video of Sweeney and... everything else, I just moved to New York. It was working with Harold Prince and Stephen Sondheim and Angela Lansbury.
Oh, it was such an extraordinary show.
Right, and I knew it was the end, so that's why I was crying.
Boy, I don't blame you for crying.
And my parents, I mean, they didn't know what the heck was going on. Can you imagine somebody else, not their daughter, comes back out on stage? I mean, they were like, what is going on? We don't remember this, because they'd been there on opening night, you know? But... all I was really thinking about when I was going down the chute, my parents had promised to take me out to my favorite seafood restaurant. So I was thinking, I think Dad's paying, I'll get the surf and turf. And then this whole thing happened, and it was so, but it teaches you a lesson, because in life you think, oh, I thought I had my whole career mapped out for me and that I'd gotten off to such a great starting point, and little did I know what lay ahead of me. And, or still, my career is just... so it's a very funky career, in that I'm continually crossing the line of opera and musical theater. And people, everyone likes to put people in niches because it makes people feel safe and comfortable. And I do the same thing myself. But for a career, it's often hard because people don't know, what they should do, or, if I'm really a Mimi, or if I should be singing, Annie, get your gun. I don't know.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Angelina Rayo's new album of Kurt Weill songs, Stranger Here Myself, is on Koch International. This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports on the possibility of NATO troops being used in Europe for peacekeeping operations. It's been suggested NATO forces could even operate outside of NATO territory. From Philadelphia, a review of the performance of Willie Williams as police chief there, looking forward to his new job as the chief of police in Los Angeles. Linda Wertheimer reports from California on a U.S. House race that revolves around the issue of abortion. We'll talk with an attorney about the difficulties of trying to prove political persecution if you live in Haiti and want to leave. And we'll talk with members of Project Troubadour, getting set to go off to Russia and make some music.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. News coverage of the Rodney King beating and its aftermath tapped some time-honored linguistic usages for the words force and violence. This led linguist Jeff Nunberg to consider the difference between these two words.
I found a curious thing when I looked up the words force and violence in Merriam-Webster's Ninth Collegiate Dictionary. It had defined each word in terms of the other. One sense of force is given as violence or compulsion exerted against a person or thing. But the corresponding meaning of violence is given as exertion of physical force so as to injure or abuse. It raises an interesting point, because violence and force may be close in meaning, but they're not words you can use interchangeably. Take the statement made by President Bush when he sent 4,500 troops to Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. Let me assure you, I will use whatever force is necessary to restore order. I guarantee you, this violence will end. Bush was clear enough about the distinction. Force is the prerogative of official power. Violence is the desperate expedient of the powerless. It isn't just a question of justification or legitimacy. We use force even when power is abused. Saddam Hussein tried to take Kuwait by force. The cops who beat Rodney King were charged with excessive use of force. But it was violence when rioters pulled a driver from his truck and beat him, even though the videotapes of the two incidents looked eerily alike. To check this theory, I pulled 500 citations of the word violence from a newspaper database. In all, the word was used only 4 times to refer to the actions of official authorities, twice for the Haitian army, once for the South African police, once for the former military regime in Brazil. The rest of the time, violence referred to unauthorized actions by soccer fans, rioters, strikers, demonstrators, guerrillas, or often the perpetrators of violence weren't mentioned at all. It's notable how often the word violence is used as the subject of a sentence. Political violence flared anew in Haiti. A wave of violence has swept over this Central American country. As violence rocked Los Angeles this week, violence breaks out, erupts, explodes, escalates, ebbs. We talk about it as if it were a thing with a life of its own, a kind of eczema on the body politic. The people who do it are anonymous or irrelevant, like the passive hosts of a disease. Whereas force doesn't erupt by itself. It's always the object of the verb. Someone uses force, deploys force, exercises force. You can see the difference in Bush's statement. I will use whatever force is necessary. I guarantee you this violence will end. But of course, the violent acts of the powerless can be deliberate, premeditated, purposeful. And the Lord knows the violent acts of official authorities can be spontaneous. What we saw in the Rodney King video was precisely an outbreak of force, except that the language doesn't allow us to describe it that way. But the difference is only one of perspective. If we speak of violence as a kind of anonymous social condition, it's because the powerless are usually invisible until they act, whereas force comes from the people we already have our eye on. You begin to appreciate the difficulty that the lexicographers have with these words. Violence and force are made of the same stuff. We simply give it different names according to where it appears. The danger in this is that we may wind up thinking of violence and force as qualitatively different things, the way the ancients thought that the morning star and the evening star were different astronomical bodies. And of course, it makes it easy for the powers that be to go on record as opposing violence, since the language leaves them semantically exempt from committing it. That's why some people have made it a point to use the word violence to refer to the injuries visited by the agents and institutions of the established order. Malcolm X used to talk this way, but so did Bobby Kennedy. Because it's well to remember that violence is most deceptive when it puts on a uniform and takes another name.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Joan Tui, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, I'm dysfunctional, you're dysfunctional. Wendy Kaminer took a critical look at the recovery movement. She says that if you look at the 12-step concepts in a political context, you'll see an authoritarian and conformist message. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.